Welcome to Life Sciences and Science Life, a science podcast of the University of Vienna's Doctoral School of Pharmaceutical, Nutritional and Sports Sciences.
Our team of PhD candidates, along with various experts in the field, talk about current advances in sciences while exploring the challenges and triumphs of PhD life.
Today, we will discuss musculoskeletal modeling with Alexander Purzel, a PhD candidate in biomechanics at the University of Vienna. Alexander is not only a researcher, but has more than 25 years of competitive strength training experience. As a powerlifter and a coach, Alex has won numerous championships for the Austrian national team. We are delighted to have you here with us. Hi, Alex.
Hello, Harry, and hello, Ranjit. First of all, I'm really flattered for this kind introduction of yours. So thank you very much. And I'm really thankful to be invited here at your podcast. And I'm really looking forward for the topics you're talking about.
We can start with your general background, how you got attracted to strength training and how it evolved into a professional powerlifting career.
This was a long time ago, Ranjit. So it was 1998 when I first started strength training. So it's now 27 years ago. And I started because, you know, my mother started in a gym, and she took me with her. And the first time I just get my hands on a barbell, I was addicted to it. And that's how I started strength training. I don't know what's the fascination of strength training for me, but it just got me. And I trained since then for decades now. And I did my first competition in 2009 in powerlifting. And 2013 to 2018, I was in the national powerlifting team and represented Austria in couple of European world championships. It was great stuff. And now I'm still, you know, training 5 times a week. Actually, I was training before I came here because I thought, okay, I have to just make some dumbbell flies just to pump up before the podcast.
Can you recall the moment when you realized you wanted to take your passion for sport?
Actually, absolutely. Actually, in the second I started training, because, you know, back in 1998 or before 2000, there was kind of, okay, there was internet, but, you know, you had no YouTube. You had some kind of websites where people are, you know, talking about what they do, and that's it. And I was fascinating about, okay, how many sets should I do? Like, everybody's asking that, you know, how many reps should I do? How much weight should I take? And should I go to failure every time? And I started, you know, studying sports. Actually, I studied sports and history. So I have a master in education. And I started that 2002 and finished it, you know, I don't know when, 2008, something like that. And it fascinated me. But then I don't think I made a mistake. But then I started to be a teacher and I really loved it. But I was still missing something, you know. And then during being a teacher, I started to be self-employed, giving some seminars, talking to people about strength training. And fortunately, 2021, some old friend of mine just pushed me into the academic field and said, hey, maybe a PhD is the right thing for you. And then I started it. It was some great push.
So today you would like to talk about something about musculoskeletal modeling, right?
Yes.
As a pharmacist or in a general audience, we are not aware what is musculoskeletal modeling. What's your thoughts on this?
Actually, when I started a PhD, I didn't know it either. I thought it was kind of a different thing. But what it is it's like something you just, like in pharmacy or in nutritional science, you just cannot study on a person. You cannot study on a human. For example, how high are the joint loads? Because then you have to implant something into the joint, and that's not possible in non-injured people. And so you have to have models, and those are in silico models. So these are computer models where they are very elaborated. So they're, of course, they are generic, but they grew over the last 20 years. So it's like there is everything in the model, or at least a lot of things in the model that are also in humans. So how long are the bones? Where are the muscles going? Where are the attachments of the muscles? The insertion? How goes the muscle about over the joint, for example? What's the optimal muscle length? When the muscle is shortening at a certain amount of time, how strong is the muscle? What's the muscle volume? And so on and so on. How does the joint look? And then you can bring a movement people are doing into this model. And then you can calculate, for example, muscle forces, what muscle forces and joint forces that are, you know, when the human is doing the movement, then there are muscle forces and joint forces that will rise, of course. And in the model, you can calculate that because you cannot calculate it in the human being. And that's a muscular skeletal model. So you can calculate things according to muscles and things according to the skeletal frame of the body. And the more input you have, the more exact the model is. But, you know, every model is just every, you know, that every model is false, you know, every model is wrong, but some models are useful and others are not. And we are trying to have, we know that we have not the perfect model, but hopefully they're useful. That is what my supervisor would say now.
What is the relation that we also mentioned about biomechanics?
Yeah.
So what is biomechanics and how it's related to musculoskeletal modeling?
That's a perfect question. Musculoskeletal modeling is a part of biomechanics. So biomechanics is like, you know, you have sports science, mm-hmm. and then you have biomechanics of movement. Mm-hmm. So that's how you would describe movement and why movement can happen. So it's describing movements. How fast is the movement? What angular velocity you have? What angles are in different joints during the movement and so on? And what forces drive the movement? Mm-hmm. And what's the results of the movement? Biomechanics can calculate, those things. Mm-hmm. And musculoskeletal model is some kind of methods you use for calculating those things. Okay. It's not the only method biomechanics have, but it's a very, it's an in silico method biomechanics have. And it's perfect for things you just cannot measure in the human being. You just, for example, you cannot measure how in 5 years, if you keep on moving the way you move, mm-hmm. your bone will change. Mm-hmm. But musculoskeletal modeling mm-hmm. will allow you to calculate those changes and say to you, okay, maybe your bone is changing like this and that's not good. Or maybe if you move like that, it's way better for your knee because you have, for example, some kind of osteoarthritis going on in your knee and you have a bad knee. And musculoskeletal modeling can tell you if you change the way you walk, if you change the way you move, maybe the joint load on the knee is different, is lower, and that's better for you in the long run. That is what musculoskeletal modeling is. It's just a part. It's a method of biomechanics.
So one question, I think, how do you generate these models? What kind of data do you use? Because it sounds very interesting, but
where does all these things come
exactly,
from?
Yeah.
For the models to, the models need a lot of data from, dead people. You know, because in dead people, you can measure from where to where the muscle is pulling, how big are the joint surfaces, how are the joint surfaces, how many muscles pull in this direction, how does that change when you move the body, how long actually are the myofibrils, how long are the fascicles, and so on and so on and so on. So you have a lot of data from kind of dead people on the one hand, but you have also data from MRI or medical imaging on the other hand. So you can put in those things too. And then you have a generic model, a model that kind of fits all. And of course you can use those generic models and they're not bad, but the more you build them subject specific, the better they get and the more accurate they get. So for example, we were testing elite powerlifters. Of course, the generic models doesn't account for elite powerlifting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But first of all, you scale the models to the anthropometry of the participants. So that, for example, the shank is the length of the shank of the athlete, or the upper arm is the length of the upper arm of the athlete, or the weight is kind of the weight of the athlete. That's a scaling process. But then you can also make them subject specific, and you can put in some MRI data. For example, how exactly does the femur, the bone of the upper leg look like? Is there some kind of deviation from the standard model? And if there is, and you put this in the musculoskeletal modeling, of course, the calculations are more exact. Mm-hmm. And you can also put in some kind of muscle volume data, because those people have way more muscle mass than, you know, generic people. And then you can put in the muscle volume, and then the model gets stronger. For example, when we used the generic models for calculating those things, those generic models were not able to support the loads our athletes were using. Mm-hmm. So there were the muscles were at 100% of their maximum, and we needed more muscle force because the muscles were not able to, you know, support that load. So we had to increase the muscle force of the models according to the MRI imaging. And that is why we needed MRI imaging. But that makes the whole thing very expensive. But for let's say general population, a generic model is not that bad, mm-hmm. but it's not that exact. And if you need exact measurements, for example, in a medical environment or in an athletic environment, you have to build them subject specific.
Thank you. I mean, it sounds very, very interesting. And maybe we wanted to see more in the real world application of these models. Could you share us some applications?
Sure. For example, first of all, we calculated super high joint forces during squats in elite powerlifting. You know, those joint forces in the knee, they were kind of 20 to 30 times body weight. So I know this is a wrong terminus now, but if one athlete weighed 100 kilograms, the joint load was way above 2 tons between the upper bone of the bone of the upper leg and the bone of the shank. That's insane. Even if those models are not super accurate, that's super high. And what is the practical application for that? And that's my interpretation. That's not the outcome of the research. So sorry for that. Now there's an interpretation. Yeah. But as a coach and as an athlete, I think people, because there are a lot of longitudinal studies about weightlifters, some of those studies say that it's bad for your cartilage. You have a higher possibility to get osteoarthritis. And some studies say the complete difference, that weightlifting is good for you and good for your joints and good for your cartilage. And why is this, you know, this discrepancy between those two? And I think it's because of those high loads, especially in elite sports. And if you applicate those high loads all year round, I think the body isn't able to compensate that. I think you need periodization. You need phases in your training where you have a lot of high loads, a lot of volume, especially around your competitions. But you also have to have phases where the loads are, maybe they're that high, but with way less volume. So instead of doing 20 set squats, you're just doing 3 sets of squats. So your body can compensate, your body can adapt to those loads. And I think that's a real world application, because if you know that the joint loads are really high and you calculated those through your musculoskeletal modeling, you can draw conclusions for your training, for your periodization. That's in the athletic field. But there was also in the medical field a lot of application. For example, if people with cerebral palsy, mm-hmm. they have problems moving, and you can calculate with musculoskeletal modeling, or hopefully you can do that, how this movement will affect the growth of the bone, especially in children. And when you know how the movement will change your bone within the next 5, 6, 7, maybe 10 years, maybe you can intervene with some kind of different training strategies, a different way of walking. Or you can say that maybe if those people need surgery, you can exactly tell people in the hospital what surgery you need and not just cut the bone and put it together again. And that's happening now, you know? And young children have surgery 6, 7, 8 times in a very young age. And only a fractional part of those children are getting better because of the surgery, and a lot of having troubles because of the surgery. And then you, if you incorporate musculoskeletal simulations, maybe you can help those people. Yeah, that's a real time, a real world application. I hope I explained it to you enough, Ranjit. I don't know.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So you are a coach, right? And yes. Also you are trying to get these models into your real life day of coaching. This for your students or your whoever you are training.
Yeah.
Do you go with any particular model on this musculoskeletal modeling? Do you use something before or after?
You mean
something?
In the coaching process?
Yes.
That would be the future.
Okay.
But what, and I think there are some studies going on and some research going on where you have some kind of real-time feedback, how the movement affects your joint loads, how the movement affects your muscle forces. But those are normally, okay, the movement is not generic, the movement is subject specific, but the models are more or less generic. But if you manage to have some kind of MRI data of yourself and you have some kind of variables where you have EMG sensors or IMUs, this is inertial measurement units. So when you move, they detect your movements. And when you have this model and you have a real-time feedback of what you are doing, how it affects your body, how it affects your joint, your injured joint, for example, or what would be perfect is the movement, is the load you're using enough to increase your muscle mass, for example. So that's very far in the future. Yeah. But that, I think that's the point we will go. And I think in the next 5 to 10 years, we will see those things in commercial gyms. I'm pretty sure we have that because, you know, these wearables, you just wear a t-shirt, you have some kind of EMG sensors in it. So they measure the muscle activation. You have some IMUs, they measure the movement. And then you can, for example, put in how much load you take. You have a model, and this model tells you, okay, you really lose your latissimus dorsi when you pulled on the rowing machine. That's fine. Or you use the wrong muscle because you don't want to use this muscle, perhaps because you want to train the other muscle. So maybe you should do another exercise. I think that's the future in coaching, and where you use those musculoskeletal modeling in coaching in the future.
It seems interesting, like we are nowadays monitoring our footsteps.
Yes.
By using our smartwatches, right? Something like this.
Absolutely. I think there is some things going on, and some time needs to be used for, you know, research. But I know some people, they are already researching in these fields, especially in people who are not able to walk because of some kind of injury. And they trying to help those people to move again. And that works already.
One of the concerns that just popped in my head was that this involves a lot of personal data and a lot of anatomical, and there should be a lot of ethical concerns.
Absolutely.
And guidelines and stuff like that. Could you shed some light on that and tell us how it's handled?
That's in my opinion, that's one of the biggest problems in the whole field. I think it's not a big problem in the scientific academic field. But as soon as some companies get their hand on this stuff, and they will, and it's a problem. And then you have to have regulations. Mm-hmm. And that's not that's a problem, because that's not up to us, because it's completely normal for us scientists to have those regulations and to respect them. But that's a big thing. I'm really glad that you just talked about that, because I don't want people to know too much about me.
Especially for athletes who are competing at...
Absolutely. Or especially, not even for athletes, especially for people who maybe have some kind of bodily problem. And if they're kind of, they don't want people to know that, because maybe that's not a problem for work or something like that. But, you know, if some kind of company knows that, maybe it's a problem.
Yeah.
And that shouldn't be the case.
So as a scientist, you know, we have always some limitations, whatever our research study goes on. So what do you think about the limitations of this model?
You know, it sounded great, everything, you know, but the limitations are big. The limitations are super big. You know, there is some kind of validation you can do with musculoskeletal modeling. I'm pretty sure you all know people who have implants in their knees, who have some kind of artificial knees, endoprothetic stuff going on in the hips or in the knees. And there are some kind of instrumented endoprothetic knees and hips. So there are force plates in those knees, and they can calculate the forces in the knees exactly. And we know that the forces in the musculoskeletal modeling, the joint forces, are higher than the actual joint forces in the in the real knee. Let's put it like that. It's an artificial knee, I know, but it's in the person. Yeah. So they are not 100% accurate. And the bigger the movement, the bigger the range of motion, the higher the difference between the forces in the model and the forces in the person. And that's one big problem. The next big problem is you will never have everything in this model that's in the human being. And you cannot, because, okay, maybe you can have a lot of things in there, but it's super expensive. You know, if you need a whole body MRI, first of all, it costs you thousands of euros for one person. And we know that one person is that's not enough for a study. The next thing is that you have to segment muscles and segment bones. And there's especially for segmenting muscles, that's still a process that's not automatically done. You have to do it by hand. And, you know, that needs a lot of working hours. And that there are a lot of limitations here in the musculoskeletal modeling field. And of course, if we have some data, we are not 100% sure if the absolute values fit. But that's why we don't look at them that much. We look at changes in the models. Does the forces go up? Do the forces go up? Do the forces go down? And that's more important than the absolute force we reading out the model. So there are limitations, a whole lot of limitations. And people have to think about them before saying, okay, this movement generates 30 times body weight contact forces in your knee joint. Maybe that's not the case. Maybe it is. Maybe it's higher. Maybe it's lower. But what's more important is if you, for example, change the movement, does the force increase or does it decrease? Because that's maybe more important, and that's more accurate than the absolute numbers.
Great. So you mentioned about the cost of doing an MRI.
Mm-hmm.
I was curious, it's like, how accessible can this technology be for someone in the future? And will it be ever accessible for healthcare? No.
I don't know. Actually, I don't know. And I don't know what I want to think about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on the one hand, I don't know how you are thinking about that, guys, but on the one hand, you want to know everything. But on the other hand, actually, maybe you don't want to know everything. There's have to be some kind of mystical stuff going on.
Yeah.
As well. And I don't know why I think that, but that feels more comfortable that we as human beings have not, the access to everything, you know. And I think it's not getting cheaper.
Okay.
Not that much, you know. So you can say maybe okay, I go to MRI and then I have a whole body scan. Maybe if you have an AI program and you put in you know your MRI scans and those are segmenting the muscles automatically and so on. Okay, then you pay 2,500 euros once and then you have your model, but it's not accessible for everyone. Mm-hmm. It's accessible for people who can afford 1,500 euros, and then you buy the program in the future. You know, that's not that mm-hmm. that's cheap, that not that cheap, and so on and so on. So it's accessible for people who have money.
Okay,
that's a problem, and that's why we need funding, not for athletes, because okay, athletes normally have money, but we need it for people who don't have money, and or maybe they don't have money, and that are people who are suffering from, for example, injuries, or you are suffering from some kind of diseases. And that is what we need funding and so on and so on and so on.
Yeah, especially, you know, when I think about the context of rehabilitation for people who have surgeries or who had accidents, or even old people who have problems, chronic pain. I mean, it's important to address these things, and I feel confident that these models can help them in their recovery.
Absolutely. What we are doing with athletes, okay, that sounds cool and fine and everything, but it's not that important what, for example, my supervisor is doing with cerebral palsy kids. Mm-hmm. Because they need the help of very intelligent people like my supervisor is, hello Hans. We've already finished the process of, you know, saying if everything is fine. But they need the help, and they don't have the lobby behind them who can pay for, you know, for insane stuff. You're absolutely right. I'm 100% with you. That's where our knowledge has to go. As scientists or coaches or whatever.
I'm sure your research and the team's work will.
I hope. Push us I really hope. That, yeah. I really hope. I'm proud of the team who is doing that at our university. I really am. I tell, you know, if some people are talking about, okay, cool, what you are doing about athletes, I always talk about, okay, that's cool, but you know what's really important is what are they doing with children who has diseases or have movement impairments. Way more important.
Thank you for joining us today, Alexander. It was great talk by you, and the perspectives were so good. Thank you so much.
I was really happy to talk to you guys, and it's very interesting questions. I think the questions are very, very important for people to understand musculoskeletal modeling. And I have one last thing to say, and that's, I think, the most important thing. Just load your body and it will adapt in a positive way. So go and work out.
Great. That was wonderful.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you.
That's it for this episode of Life Sciences and Science Life. We are your hosts, Ranjit and
Hari.
Tune in next month for more intriguing science topics, relatable PhD experiences, and expert contributions on how to navigate a career path of a young scientist.
Our next episode is going to be about proteomics and the life beyond the genome with Dr. Fang Xian. This is a podcast of the University of Vienna's Doctoral School of Pharmaceutical, Nutritional and Sports Sciences. Don't forget to follow us on LinkedIn. Thank you for listening. See you next time.